is a one-trick pony. One trick is all at home.
Hello and welcome to episode 194 of the Film Yak Podcast. I'm John.
I'm Kevin.
And I'm JR.
Now on this week's episode, we're talking about my pick, One Trick Pony, directed by Robert M. Young, starring and written by Paul Simon, the famous balladeer of Simon and Garfunkel, and it's his lone starring picture role. I'm sure he ever acted in anything, actually, except for this, but maybe he did. I don't know. We're going to be talking about that as well as other stuff we watched. A lot of new things in the pipe for this episode, for me anyway. I watched a ton of shit. I'm not going to talk about all of it, obviously, because we haven't recorded in over a month. And I have maybe 30 films that I've watched since then. But I'm going to talk about the select few that are worthy of praise and disdain. How are you guys doing?
Doing fantastic. I have also watched a lot, and I am sad to report that most of what I've seen is garbage. It's been a slog 4 weeks for me with a few standouts.
That's
unfortunate.
Yeah, I'm sort of in the same boat with JR. I didn't have quite as many like really bad things as he did, but most of the stuff I've seen, it's like, it's fine.
Summer doldrums, you know. Wish there was stuff going on. Not at the movies. There's plenty going on at the movies. Wish there was stuff going on in my Blu-ray player. It's not happening right now though.
Yeah, and you know, for context, sorry.
No, you're good. Go ahead.
For context, for people who, you know, new to the show, maybe don't follow it as closely, JR doesn't rate things very... He doesn't rate things super high a lot of the time, but he also doesn't rate things super low most of the time. Like, he's pretty even-handed with his ratings. So if he gives something... If he gives something a 5, it's probably a really good movie. If he gives something a 1, you can pretty much bet that it's crap. So, yeah.
Obviously, I'm surprised you guys haven't given me a nickname like a like 3-star pass. Like that's all I am, you know. Did he even watch that, or just rated 3 stars?
I feel like I've said something like that to you before, but I don't know.
Probably.
This is also an historic show, our first triple time zone recording. I've recently moved to the Atlanta, Georgia area, and so I'm in Eastern time zone now. Kevin's still in Central, and JR, of course, in Mountain. Right, Mountain?
Yeah, yes. The time zone that people can't remember exists, legitimately.
Right.
Hey, if you're on the West Coast, or if you're in the Western time zone, and you think you'd jive with our sensibilities and sense of humor, send an email. You know, we need a guest host for that fourth time zone.
We should get a fourth permanent co-host, so we're in all 4 time zones.
Yeah.
that would be great. But anyway, I don't think there's anything news-wise. I mean, maybe there is. I don't even know. Is there anything worthy of discussion? I don't recall. The Digger trailer, I guess, came out. JR is sickened. He hates Inarritu. We all know this.
All the characters look sickly. I am sickened by... everything in that trailer just screams like, hey, here's our satire served up on a platter. You won't have to think about anything. It will be incredibly obvious the entire time. And if I'm wrong, wonderful. I'd be excited for him to make a good movie.
I mean, you could say the same thing for other films that you've enjoyed, though, right? I mean, like...
No, you couldn't.
The Mickey 17 satire is not terribly obscure, you know?
No, it's not. And I... Again, I'm talking about like a 2-minute trailer.
He can't
just
talk
like,
about Bong Joon-ho though. He can't diss Bong.
Don't you dare. No, but just like I think there are really cool things in that movie, and I don't think it's like not every shot in Mickey 17 is filmed at this insanely low angle. And I don't know that that's true in Diggers too, but like the trailer, just like how much of it is filmed from that angle, how everyone has like the same makeup. It's just like it's like a snapshot of this movie.
I don't know what that means. They don't all have the same makeup. I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, dude, they're all like, they're all out of some like gross Tim Burton movie with this makeup. It's icky.
Yeah, I mean they're definitely all wearing makeup. But I don't know.
Prove me wrong, Tom Cruise.
I'm mildly excited. I'm excited to see Tom Cruise in a non Mission Impossible, non Doug Liman or Ed Zwick picture, you know, or non Macquarie picture for once in the last 20 years, you know. So I think that's worthy of excitement in and of itself, personally, but we'll see, you know? We'll have to wait and see. Who could know? All right, well, let's jump right into it, I guess. Hey?
Sure.
One Trick Pony. The movie from 1980, which I don't think I said in the intro, directed by Robert M. Young. And written by and starring Paul Simon, also starring Rip Torn and Blair Brown and some other people, very few of whom are recognizable, I'd say. But you do have Harry Shearer in there. You got Lou Reed in a weird small role. And you got Daniel Stern.
Mayor Winningham. Who I did not know about, and I looked up. She's been nominated for an Oscar, but she was in.
Oh yeah, that's right. Another
movie I watched like right after this called Shy People, which is like, whoa, that's crazy. Weird.
What was she nominated for?
Can't remember. It was a. I can find it real quick. But it was a movie that I don't think I would ever watch.
It was one of those like. Right, yeah. It's like one of those things you never heard of.
1995.
And
Jennifer Ulu Grosbard, director of Straight Time. Jason Lee and Mare Winningham is her mother. Older sister. Sorry, I won't watch this. She had a nice little scene.
Sorry about that.
I just realized that he was talking. Sorry.
It's okay. Mayor Winningham, she's not bad in this too, and she's not in it very long. But she'd be like one of the sort of standout performances for me. But I had no idea who she was prior to this. But this is a movie that is about a guy named Jonah, who had a hit song in the 60s, a Vietnam protest song, a la Bob Dylan-esque sort of thing going on called Soft Parachutes. Now he's just a regular blue-collar touring musician. He's sort of forgotten, and he's touring around with his like blues band to different little podunky bars and, you know, just making a living. And I wouldn't say he's estranged from his wife. They're not together.
Yeah, but they're separated.
They say separated.
They definitely, yeah, but I mean, but I don't know. Estranged makes it sound like they don't talk to each other and they seem to have like a lot of face-to-face time. He's trying to juggle that along with being a father to his young son and potentially bringing back Soft Parachutes, recording another record off the popularity of that single all these years later, and the various artistic integrity in integrity questions of integrity that come with it. So what'd you guys think of One Trick Pony?
Hey, Kevin.
Well, the first thing I thought when I was watching the movie, are either of you guys familiar with Steely Dan?
A little. Only in the sense that I've heard some music. I don't know anything about like their story or anything.
F and no static at all. Bop, 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 bop. Right.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this was what Paul Simon was going for at the time, but like, especially that first song, One Trick Pony, like, oh, you've been listening to some Steely Dan, and like, you know, you've got like, you know, some like real hardcore like jazz musicians as your backing band, a la, you know, Joni Mitchell, late 70s. So it's like, it's interesting because like, you know, Steely Dan was having some pretty good hits. So it was interesting to see like he's playing this kind of stuff and he's apparently like not like the record company doesn't like it and et cetera, et cetera. It's like,
Speaking of the band, did you realize that the bassist was played in King Crimson?
I did, yeah. And when you first watched it back in what, 2020, 21?
Yeah, maybe 2021, 22, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, like when you first mentioned it, like I looked up who was in the movie and I was like, oh, Tony Levin, Steve Gadd, you know, like.
Yeah, I don't know any of these people. I saw.
Yeah.
I looked them up after, like, I'm watching the movie. I'm like, okay, these guys are clearly not actors. They're musicians because they're playing. Yeah. They're clearly playing. And then I just looked them up. I was like, oh, this fucking guy's in King Crimson for, you know, 10 years in the 80s or whatever it was.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, King Crimson, Peter Gabriel, he's played with Pink Floyd. Like, I mean, you name them, he's probably played with them. So, and I think, like, I'd seen an interview with him where he was talking about, like, doing recordings with Paul Simon. So, so yeah, that was interesting and, you know, cool to see. Yeah, because, like, I'm not super well versed in Paul Simon's music, but I've heard, you know, I've heard Graceland, I've heard, you know, the hits by Simon and Garfunkel, so.
You can call me Al.
Yeah, which is, funnily enough, Adrian Belew, who's also in King Crimson, he's the one doing the horn parts in You Can Call Me Al on his guitar synth.
Wow.
So yeah. There are no horns in that song.
I think there are like some just actual horns, synths. But like the actual like dun 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 dun, the hook is him. So
that's crazy.
To nitpick your point, Kevin, or not to nitpick, to ask a question, I was like, does the record label dislike his new music, or do they just not care? And they're like, they went into that meeting or those meetings kind of like, we have an idea for how to make your music profitable. We have no interest in what you've actually shown up here with today.
You make a very good point, JR.
That was the vibe I got, like Rip Torn and Lou Reed. And there was one other guy just like, oh, this is what I said in my profile guy. You know, that executive had just had the like magazine profile written about him that he kept bringing up. Like I just didn't think they were interested in hearing the music. They were just like, this is a guy on our roster. This is an artist on our roster who is not making us money. Let's see if we can do something different that will make us money.
And he's coming off of they talked him into playing this hit that he had. So now he's got the hit and it's reminded everybody who he is. So he's able to, they're trying to parlay that into something, I think, you know. Sorry, give me one second.
But you know who likes him? You know who listens to him, Kevin?
Mm.
Rip Torn's wife.
Yeah. She listens very closely.
she listens.
Yeah.
And you know what? I would say, in general, the women in this movie listen to Paul Simon much more than the other people do.
Yeah.
This is true. Yeah. Why he's drawn to these women.
Sure.
Yeah.
For no other reason.
Or they're drawn to him.
Mm.
It's actually a lot of the like sort of negativity that I've seen about this film. All the negativity I've seen about this film on Letterboxd, especially, is considering. Hang on one second. I'm sorry. Just give me 1 minute.
Yeah.
Were you guys flying direct from Baltimore to Denver?
Yeah, dude. It was a pretty crazy day.
Mm.
We're like a two hour delay in the airport, and then we got on the plane, and it was like, all right, they've shut down our regular flight path, so we're gonna get in line with these other planes to take. Like the south flight, you know, like just kind of off the runway.
Mm-hmm.
And we just sat in line and they were like, all right, actually, all flight paths have been shut down. We will now kind of sit in line to wait to get back to a gate so we can get you guys off the plane. And they're like, there are no gates. So we ended up on this flight for 2.5 hours, which is like just a little bit shorter than what the flight would have been. And we're sitting in like the rain and the wind, and it's like shaking. That was interesting. I've never been in a storm, just kind of sitting on the ground.
Wow.
In a plane. But we finally got off the plane. Kind of 2 more hours in the airport. They're like, all right, don't leave this area where we let you off. And it was like 5. And they're like, we know that we will not have an update until 7. Because air traffic control is trying to get rid of the planes that are scheduled, and then they'll figure out where they can slot us in. And I was like, well, that sucks. So we're never leaving. But then at like 7:10, they were like, all right, your pilot has timed out. It's like, okay, we could have seen that coming. But like 10 minutes later, it's basically like, there's a new pilot. Everyone get on the plane right now.
Jeez.
There's more weather coming at 8. So let's get load quickly. That weather never came, but somehow our flight that was supposed to be 3 hours, once we finally got up, was closer to 4 hours. I don't know what happened.
Mm.
And a lot of babies on the flight, but we lost the lottery. Eloise, who's just like 2, she was the one losing her mind for almost all of those 4 hours, which...
Yeah.
It's like she won't nap in a car seat. She won't nap in a plane.
Okay.
So, damn. Disaster. But we got home at midnight. It was good.
Nice.
Sorry. Just the dog issues, Dog's out of control. But anyway. I was saying that the only criticism I've really seen about the film, or the only like substantive criticism, and I think personally, I feel like it's maybe one of 2 things that I could say that I dislike about the film, or not that I dislike about the film, but things that you could point out that are criticisms. Because I personally think the film is very well made. I think it's really well directed. I think it's well written. I think a lot of the performances are good. And I think, especially like the non-actors, very natural, lends a sort of weirdness to it. Again, I think I had mentioned when I talked about this movie before, there's like I feel like a Linklater vibe to a lot of it, where it's just like it is a sort of like plotless, meandering road movie, in a lot of ways. But the criticism I see over and over again is that it's like this vanity project for Simon, and that he's written himself as the leading man who beds like every woman he comes in contact with, pretty much, you know, which I could see that, you know, that being
he does.
He does.
There are only three women and he does sleep with all of them.
Sure. But it's like, I don't know. It's like, I don't know how unrealistic that is.
Oh, he's a
you want to say
star.
Like, oh, well, he exactly. He's a rock star. It's like, well, you know, he's 4'5" or whatever, but it's like, yeah, but he's a rock star. And he did, like, even in this, the world of this movie, Jonah had a hit. Like, he could parlay that into bedding some beautiful women, I'm sure, you know, even 12 years later or whatever.
Like, and like, one of the women he sleeps with is his, like, separated wife, you know, like, that barely counts. That, you know, it's a moment of drama. Right. And the other two, it's like, he has these women, like, they see him perform. Like, you know, it's this idea that, like, he is a magnetic performer. He has charisma. It is a vanity project, 100%. That is not a reason for me personally to dislike this movie.
Right.
You know, their vanity projects are not bad by definition. And, you know, like, I have a feeling that Paul Simon has slept with more than three women.
Okay, so JR, those aren't reasons for you to dislike the movie. Give us the reasons you do dislike this movie. Go ahead.
Great.
He's like, let me at it.
No. So, like, some of what you just said, you know, about the Linklater of it all and the kind of vibe and the plotlessness, it's like that's all there for me. And then I think some of it just doesn't work as well as I want it to. I think there are good individual scenes in this movie. I do like that scene with Mayor Winningham at the beginning. I think, like, it starts off with, like, I was like, are we doing, like, weird exposition about, like, him asking about a boyfriend and stuff and her going into all this? But, you know, but then it's not. It's sort of just like, we're just chatting and we're going to take a bath together and we're going to get into some stuff. And that's, I like that scene a lot. I like the first scene with Rip Torn and the other executive, you know, where Rip Torn's wife comes in as well. Like, I think there are these really good scenes. And then I think there are scenes that are weirdly overwritten in some bad ways, like the first scene with his wife, when he, like, surprises her by showing up at the apartment. And I wrote down a couple of, like, the lines in here is when he's like, oh yeah, where's my kid? And she's like, he's at his playgroup on Wednesdays. And he says, oh yeah, I bet he'll be surprised to see me. There's, like, such obvious, like, hold my hand as an audience member. It was like, this is not how people who have known each other so long would talk. Like, it's a very strange conversation for two people who know each other this well. And then he's like, wow, you get a little separated and you forget all about the strawberry yogurt.
Yeah.
One of the most poorly written jokes I can imagine. Right. So it's like, we're going for the naturalistic dialogue, and occasionally we are missing the mark. And I don't think Simon is good enough to pull off kind of, like, the more awkward dialogue. I don't think Simon's bad for the movie. I think he's bad in scenes.
Also, and I think he's bad at being a dramatic actor. Also, it's like, where the film gets dramatic between him and his wife specifically is the weakest part of the film for me too. I mean, like, I don't love that scene. I don't like the scene where they end up sleeping together. Although I do like the line. I agree. There's an overwritten line there too, where he says, let's have a couple more laughs here before we fall into a post-coital depression. I think it's a good line. It's overwritten, but it's good. You know, it's fun.
He can't do that. He can't do that.
Right. Exactly. It's like a Woody Allen line, you know, like, so you wouldn't expect,
maybe that,
like,
was the point.
Paul Simon necessarily, but
it probably was the point. Like, because he probably was like, oh, this kind of moment is, like, really clever. I'll just do that. And then, like, you know, he
wearing
can't
the, wearing the influences on his sleeve. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, why wouldn't he be a fan of Woody Allen's movies at this point when Woody Allen is making massive, you know, best picture winners that are little slice of life ditties. I wrote down like, this is a real attempt at a slice of life movie that moves without deference to plot, which I think makes, well, I mean, I don't know, it's like the Marion's apartment thing, you know, it's not like a lot of plot. I think the ending,
the plot's like backloaded, right? It's like the last act of him, his career stuff. That's the plot, right?
Which also that works for me and doesn't. It's like the very dramatic ending didn't work for me very well. But you know, all that recording stuff, friction within the band did. I like those things.
When you say the dramatic ending, do you mean him throwing the tape away down the street?
Yeah.
I fucking love that. You don't like that? I thought that was like awesome. I love the fact that he like secrets it out in the guitar case too, like the master reel, and then just like tosses it down the street. I don't know. That did work for me because it was like this last, you know, like, you know what? Fuck this shit. Like, I'm going to go back to playing on the road with my guys. This is what I'm happy doing, you know? And even though this tape represents a better life in a lot of ways, and more success and everything, he just tosses it all away. Cause again, with the integrity thing. And I think that, again, all that stuff super backloaded in the film, and you know, it's like the last like 20, 25 minutes of the movie, you're seeing all of this, like the career trajectory stuff and the arguing with Lou Reed about adding strings or whatever, you know, which is so fun too, because like Lou Reed, it feels like something that Lou Reed wouldn't do. He wouldn't be arguing to add strings to something. You know?
I had some Lou Reed questions because I'm not really a Lou Reed guy. This is actually a movie full of musicians that are like not my musicians. Like I don't care about these people. I'm not a Simon fan. I'm not a Lou Reed person. But the I did imagine, like, I don't think this is who Lou Reed is as a producer and musician. However, he's pulling off douchebag just fine, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, from everything I've heard about Lou Reed, like, very good, you know, songwriter and stuff. But yeah, kind of a douche. And also, like, especially, like, at this point, it's like, Lou Reed is not known for his hits. Like... like late 70s.
He's had some hits though.
No, he's had hits, you know, like the stuff with big hits. You know, yeah.
Is the Banana record not a hit?
No, it was. Well,
that's not him. I mean, that's his band. Take a Walk on the Wild Side was a hit, and
doesn't Lou Reed just get credit for all the Velvet Underground stuff?
John Cale wrote all the best shit on that record.
Okay,
yeah,
good for them.
And Mo Tucker.
Like at this point he's doing, you know, like, I don't know, like Street Hassle, and like it's not really like at this point, like late 70s, he's not really making hits. He's, you know, recovering from Metal Machine music and, you know, probably like on coke. But
Metal Machine music, one of his better albums. Amazing. Amazing. Give a little, JR, give it a listen. Metal Machine Music. Okay. Awesome.
Can I tell you guys a problem that I had?
Sure.
And this happens at the beginning of the movie. I don't like One Trick Pony, the song.
Oh.
Like, I don't like that song.
You don't like the song? Oh, I see.
I did not like the song.
It grew on me. It's in my regular playlist now.
Okay.
It's in heavy rotation.
I've only heard it the one time, or I guess I heard it more than once in the movie. But didn't love the song. Entire song.
Right. Wait one second. I'm sorry. As far as the song, a song goes, right, that you would like or dislike, Are you able to, for me, okay, I don't like One Trick Pony. Listening to it the first time, I'm like, musically, I'm like, this is gross. Like, this is not my kind of thing. I don't like the way the bass sounds in this song. I don't like the guitar solo in this song. It's very like sort of like what Kevin said, like this weird, you know, blues jazz late 70s. It's not my, I'm not into it, okay? Like Boz Scaggs, you know, I'm not into it, okay? But the lyric for the song, I really enjoyed even the first time I heard it. I liked Paul Simon's lyrics, and just like when he says, like, it looks so easy, he looks so clean, he moves like God's immaculate machine, like that kind of thing. I like that. I just like the lyric. I think it's like, it's really nice sounding, and I don't really understand. I mean, I guess, you know, you read, like, a lot of things into what the song's about. It's probably not about anything, honestly, but
no memory.
Is that a thing for you? Like, could the lyric be good enough to overtake the music and then make you like the music?
Could it? Probably. I just feel like the way my brain processes music, I'm it's often like just the lyrics don't really factor in until I'm hooked somewhere else.
Oh,
like,
I see.
Can't think of any music where I'm like, the lyric was
really
the first thing I liked and noticed.
That's crazy to me, man.
I feel like
Jonathan's
that,
the same way. Jonathan always talks about that too. Like, he doesn't care about lyrics. I'm just
I do care, because like once I like something, I struggle. Yeah. If I like something, I then struggle if I realize later that the lyrics are super stupid. And then I'll like the song less. But it's very rare that like the lyrics are what catch my ear first.
That's so, yeah, it's just crazy, because it's like, lately I've been listening, sorry, this is like a huge tangent, but like lately I've been listening to that song King Park by Law Dispute, like a lot.
And love that song.
It's a great song. It gets me, like, it gives me chills at the end, you know, that last line
that he repeats.
And I'm just like, those lyrics are so fucking good. I don't even care about the music. Like, the lyrics are so good, you know?
That is an interesting song. So that song was the first song I ever heard by that band. My friend sent it my way, because I love my hardcore. And I was just like, that band had not worked for me previously. And then my friend Jeremy sent me, he's like, you gotta listen to King Park. I think you're gonna like King Park. And I was just listening to it, and it was like, this sounds kind of like other Law Dispute stuff. I don't really care.
Mm-hmm.
But when he starts shouting, like, will I go to heaven?
Yeah.
I was like, okay. Yeah, my attention. Which made me like re-listen to the whole song again. So I guess that is a moment where I did notice a lyric, or the delivery of the lyric, and that made me kind of go back. And I like that whole album now, and I love that song.
Yeah, it's good.
So
I
might just
not
be thinking of examples,
but not that One Trick Pony should affect you that way, or that you should be like, oh, the lyrics are so good. That's just the way it worked for me, because like this music in the film is not my kind of music.
Wheelhouse.
Right. But you were saying about the music.
My ultimate point here was that you showed me the whole One Trick Pony song, god damn it, and you only showed me about 20 seconds of the B-52s, because they looked like they were having fun. And you know, I was like, just give me all 4 minutes of whatever song that was. And you know, that was the first full song performance from Simon, and we get a few more. And I am someone where, like, in a movie like this, I do feel like at some point you're just kind of padding the runtime. I don't need all these songs that were not, they're not supposed to be within the same club, but kind of looked like they're all filmed in the same club to me. I would believe it if you told me that was all one location, that they kind of were slightly redressing and filmed it all in 2 days. But it's like they're performing. We need to see a little bit of performances. I just don't know that it had to be a full song every time. But my guy Paul was releasing an album simultaneously and had to push those songs, damn it.
This is my one, for me, this, like, I love this movie. But this is my one criticism of the film, is that it does play like a visual album of sorts. And there's just way too much of his music in general in the film. The entire film is made up of his songs, but
at least the track list does not, at least like the songs don't appear on the album in the same order that they do in the movie or something. Like it's, at least it's not exactly
that's
the same.
Fair, I guess. And I mean, I like a couple of the songs. I like One Trick Pony and I like, the God Bless the Absentee song. I think that's good, but like all the other stuff, I could take it or leave it, mostly leave it. And it's just like, I'm like you, I would just rather like, maybe let's like, fade out in the middle of a song and just get to the next scene rather than having this, it's like a music video, of them performing on stage. And it's not terribly exciting. Now, that first time he plays One Trick Pony, they've got some cool shit, like the shot of the kick drum with the reflection. I thought that was really cool. They did more stuff like that, maybe. And I mean, you see Paul Simon like really like into it and singing. I mean, and that always is exciting, but I don't know. The performance has really sort of bummed me out this time around. And like, there's a constant music, like just wall to wall Paul Simon music, whereas like that could be interesting in a movie that wasn't written by and starring Paul Simon, but
this is a vanity project.
Sure.
That's
where I can finally see like sort of that criticism. But I still think for me the other stuff trumps that. Like I think that I like the just sort of hang out. I like them in the van. I like how Jonah drives the van, which is like a weird choice. And then he's like sort of absent from the conversation. He's just hearing them talk about stuff. And I love that the game that they play about where they're naming dead rock and roll singers. That's a really cool scene for me. And when they read the review in the paper and all that, I love that. I really love the opening scene with Daniel Stern as the Hare Krishna guy. that's where the Linklater stuff really hits me, just because it's probably just because it's like Slacker. They're just two guys walking, walking and talking.
Yeah,
but I don't know. I dig it.
I thought it was interesting. I was like, we see Daniel Stern is the former NBA commissioner.
Daniel Stern.
No. Oh my God, I wrote David Stern. I wrote NBA commissioner's name.
I thought you were saying the other way.
No, I was. I got it like double backwards. I got it backwards everywhere.
Gotcha. Were you guys ever approached by one of those Hare Krishna guys on LSU's campus?
No.
I'm the only one? Wow.
Well, and here's, I was like, we see him not following other people and not bugging everyone, just kind of like, hey, got a second? And then he follows Paul Simon. I was like, is he just picking on Simon because he's so short? Like,
yeah, is clearly.
He thinks, right? This guy's a mark.
Yeah.
He's not talking to anyone else in the band.
Yeah. It's not my first airport.
How do you get... Yeah, that's good. How do you guys feel about okay, Harry Chapin? Right? That's not bad. It's not a bad line. It's funny. Just me, I guess. Hey, I have a note here. I don't know what it means.
Okay.
Which happens sometimes when you watch a movie, a week or two before the show. I wrote "They See Empire." Is that a line or something in the movie? They See Empire.
Oh yeah, he takes his son to see Empire Strikes Back.
Oh, They See Empire Strikes Back. There you go.
Yeah,
that's right. They come out of the theater.
Yeah.
They saw Empire. Forgot Strikes about Back. That. Yeah, that's cool. Again, speaking of like the direction, I have become a big Robert M. Young fan over the years. And in addition to this film, I watched his movie Rich Kids, which came out a couple of years before this, which is incredible. And you guys should check it out because it's like the playbook for Noah Baumbach for like the first half of his career, like all the New York upper crust New York stuff that he does, you know, Francis Ha or While We're Young, these kinds of things. Very, very similar. Squid and the Whale, a lot of Squid and the Whale in Rich Kids. But yeah, I just feel like Robert M. Young is like super slept on. And I mean, I know a lot of people talk, like he's got Gregorio Tortez in the collection, and I know people
and Alan I've Brista. Heard
people talk about Alan Brista. That's true. That's actually the big one that I haven't seen from him. But and then he's also I hear people talk about Short Eyes a lot, which I didn't love, but it's good. But yeah, like this and Gregorio Cortez and Rich Kids and Triumph of the Spirit.
That's the one really, on my list.
I think they're all pretty solid, and I just feel like he's like nobody talks about him, and he's clearly like a journeyman, less than like not quite an auteur, but he's just very reliable. Like all of his films are very, very good. So check him out. You know, the most slept on filmmaker of the 70s and 80s. Late 70s and 80s.
I mean, if you just like look, you know, at like those first two rows on Letterboxd, nothing else, you know, looks to me like One Trick Pony. You know, like this looks like he did a slice of life thing that he never tried again.
Mm-hmm.
Unless.
Yeah, that's fair.
I'm misunderstanding what's going on here.
I mean, I haven't seen, again, like, there's quite a few. Like, I haven't seen Dominic and Eugene or...
A lot of Edward James Olmos.
Talent for the Game. Yeah, he loves this guy. He loves Edward James Olmos. And Edward James Olmos rocks, so it makes sense. I get it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm planning to see everything at some point. I'm five deep right now. I want to watch them all. But
let us know how caught is.
I will. Caught is. It's got a Maria Conchita Alonso.
Looks hot.
Hey, it could be.
Shit, I don't. Hey,
caught is hot.
I would watch. I would watch fucking Talent for the Game.
Yeah, dude, I know, right?
Baseball movie with Edward James Olmos, right? And Lorraine Bracco.
Yeah.
Is it Bracco, dude, or Bracco?
I think it's Bracco.
Bracco.
Bracco would be like more properly Italian for the A.
Who knows? Whatever. Do whatever you want, man. Do whatever turns you on, dude. Oh, okay. I took French and I don't remember anything. Anyway, I don't know. I don't have any more notes, really. I just like the movie a lot. And yeah. Robert M. Young rocks.
I Jonah also don't
kind of kind of an asshole. I that's my only other note. Sorry.
Oh, yeah, and good. Like good. Like this would be insufferable if he wasn't like if he was just like a perfect guy who like you know he's separated from his wife but like we can't figure out why because he's so good and. Like he also was like he has such integrity like with his art, like if all that was perfect, like this would fucking suck.
I agree. I mean, at least he had the balls to, you know, write himself in not such a flattering light. And I mean, again, of course, he sleeps with all the women in the movie, but I feel like all that's sort of justified, you know.
I mean, that stuff does happen, you know.
Yeah, totally. I mean, can you imagine that a waitress at a bar got turned on watching a rock star perform at her bar and then slept with him? I mean, yeah, I don't know. It seems pretty also, reasonable.
I mean, kind of got the sense through the conversation that, like, this was not her first time doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Fair.
You know?
Yeah.
Which is not, like, a judgment, but, like, you know, if she wants to sleep with someone, she's going to do it.
Yeah, same with the executive's wife. Like, you know,
what was her name?
Women want what they want. It's not all, you know, about the man.
Joan Hackett. Oh, that's right. Joe Hackett, who was also in another movie I watched in this time between recordings, The Terminal Man. I didn't like it. Bad movie.
This guy is he's chain reactioning off this movie.
She's like the main kind of like supporting person, like the engine of the plot for George Siegel going crazy.
Well, again, love the movie. All that being said, this did come down slightly for me. Just on the second viewing, able to see the vanity project of it all in the visual album thing I was talking about, which I wasn't a huge fan of on the second watch, but it's still a 4 out of 5 for me with a heart.
I ended up at Kevin beat me to it. I also ended up at a 3.5.
Fair.
Liked totally fair. And love, you know?
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess we should move on to our homework, Kevin.
Yeah.
Which was Jean-Luc Godard's Weekend, which I have not seen in many, many years. And had a real fun rewatch with this one. I am a Godard fan, of course, and this is one of his best films for me. I really dig it. I like the surrealism of it, the humor, the violence, the anti-capitalist sentiment, the connection to Louis Buñuel's Exterminating Angel. Kevin, what'd you think?
There were definitely things that I appreciated about it, but I don't know. I'm still not sold on Godard. I'm honestly not really sold on French New Wave in general, except for like Agnès Varda. Like that shot where, you know, they're following the couple as they're going down the street, you know, passing all the traffic, and, you know, that is insane. And that is, you know, in my opinion, the best part of the movie. But then, like, I don't know. Movies like this where they, you know, are, I don't know, presenting a certain kind of thing and trying to, like, very blatantly hand you a message, like the whole bit with the my African friend is gonna tell my story, my Algerian friend is gonna tell his story, and then they go on those monologues. I'm like, okay, I'm not here for this. Like, yes, obviously these things are important, the things that they are saying are important, but it's just, I would much rather see things going on instead of just someone yammering on about, you know, just doing all
yammering.
That's at a certain point, that's what it is, because it's all rhetoric, and it's like, okay, like, you're just. Like I've said, you know, when I was talking about Nouvelle Vague, like one of the biggest things that I appreciated about Nouvelle Vague is like all of these characters just not letting Godard get away with his bullshit, like calling him out for like, no, man, you're doing this and it's not good. Yeah, all that kind of stuff. And I don't like, I would have appreciated it. Like those two people who were like, like one of them is like, the woman is like a fairy, and like the dude is like, I don't know, like he's like quoting like Alice in Wonderland. Like if like that would have happened to have been like, oh no, like this is real in the midst of this insanity. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, that would have been great. But, and then the whole thing with, oh, what's his face? I want to say he's the kid from 400 Blows, who like he's yeah, like fighting
Jean, with Jean-Pierre Lode.
Yeah, he's fighting with both of them about you know, his car. Yeah. So yeah, there's good
stuff.
He's
also
stuff
in
about
the field. He's like reading that that treatise or whatever in the field.
Yeah.
Earlier.
And like when the guy like, you know, makes the sheep appear out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That shit rocks.
Yeah, it's good stuff. It's just
I don't know.
In my opinion, it gets mired down with the political stuff.
Well, I mean, I think like, even there's even political messaging in those surrealistic scenes, you know? I think the whole thing is it's like very clear, like you say, it does sort of hammer it over the head, but I don't know. For some reason that doesn't bother me in this. Like I was always, I just love the idea of these like sort of yuppies, you know, being like endlessly tortured. It's like this sort of guise for a critique of commercialism or capitalism, you know, in the late 60s. And, I think it's really a lot of fun to watch, and it's interesting because it's like a really serious thing that he's getting at, but it doesn't feel serious when you're watching it. It's just like steeped in comedy, and it's like farcical, and the moments where it becomes meta, where they're referring to the fact that they're in a film and that they're, you know, they're meeting like all these characters, and there's like all these guys suck. Like all we meet is lousy characters in this movie. And, I don't know. It tickles me. I enjoy it. And I love the tracking shots. Like there's so many great tracking shots in this. That long one of the traffic jam at the beginning, obviously, is amazing. And then, later on when they're at the encampment, like the sort of insurgent encampment thing, and the guy's playing drums by the lake. I always love that shot. That stuck with me from, you know, when I saw this movie 15 or 20 years ago. I still remember that. So I dig it. I love it a lot. I don't know. I mean, it's not my favorite of his, but it's up there. It's top three probably.
Kevin, can we agree that this is the best movie that Godard released in 1967? there's a lot of them.
What did he release in 67? Let's go.
Yeah, what else came out in 67?
Two or three things I know about her, which is good. La Chinoise, or Chinoisie, I don't know how to say it.
Which I like Lewis, I like
La also Chinoise. Good. Oh. Yeah, Far From good. Vietnam, which is like a...
I haven't seen that.
It's a... compilation
documentary
film, basically. Yeah, but several directors, vignettes... And then
Right. Yeah, I mean, I would say yeah, having not seen those other three.
Then we are agreed.
It's nice. The best one you've seen that he made in 67.
Yeah.
Right, Kevin?
Yeah.
I mean, it's been a long time since I've seen this, but I do have this at the top of my Godard list, and I think this is kind of where everything comes together, and also, like, from this moment, like in 1967, like it's like a long time before he makes what, you know, you could consider like a traditional film, even like calling Weekend a traditional film here. Like he goes fucking off the deep end. It's just craziness throughout the 70s. So kind of like end of an era. I think it's the best of this kind of first era. I love it.
Great film. Kevin's totally wrong. You missed the boat on this one. It's okay. JR, what else you got?
Oh my God. Where to start? All right. I'm going to start recent because it's also related to the trip I just took to Delaware, where I have a family reunion. I see some cousins. Almost exactly a year ago, my cousin who lives in Baltimore, born and raised in Baltimore, told me I needed to watch the movie The Baltimoreans, directed by Jay Duplass, who is a a Louisiana boy, and the less famous of the two Duplass brothers. He's not the one who acts, of course. That's Mark. But this is like a this is a vehicle for a comedian from Baltimore named Michael Strassner, who wrote this, and seems like he kind of reached out to Jay Duplass for help directing it. And it is a piece where this newly sober guy who starts the movie with like a pretty bleak suicide attempt is like trying to have a Thanksgiving meal with Christmas meal with his girlfriend's family. Hits himself in the face, loses a tooth, and has to go to like emergency dental procedure, and kind of ends up spending the day with his dentist, an older, recently divorced woman. And they may or may not be like falling in love. And this is kind of, it's a walk and talk. And I do think there's a lot of like attempted Woody Allen stuff, a lot of that coming from Jay Duplass, who's trying to make this feel like a Woody Allen movie, and the music is trying to make it feel like a Woody Allen movie. And it would not work at all, except that this guy, Michael Strassner, is really quite good. And the dentist that he's talking to, Liz Larson, who I've never heard of, apparently she's like a Broadway actress. She's quite good as well. So like, if these two people weren't good at walking and talking, this would suck. They are good at walking and talking. It's pretty good and funny. And man, that first scene where he's about to like hang himself in his attic, I was like, man, I'm gonna fucking hate this movie. Like, are we having a guy doing a suicide attempt, and it's just gonna be like him talking about it for 100 minutes? And it's not. Yay, thank God. This is a year old, and for some reason not on a streaming service. It's not like super easy to get your hands on. So I don't expect anyone to watch it, but it was just a cool thing that came out of nowhere. And my cousin sent it to me, again, because she's from Baltimore, but also it was like filmed in her neighborhood, and people she knows worked on the movie. So
that's cool.
Good for her. Nice. Yeah. All right, that's it.
Sweet. Kevin?
Okay. So I went back and watched a couple of Kubrick movies, and I realized that, yeah, Full Metal Jacket is just not for me. I don't have the overriding animosity toward it that I had back in 17, 18, last time I watched it. But Full Metal Jacket.
I'm sorry, you cut out when you said it to me. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, so Full Metal Jacket. I don't know. It's just not for me. I'm watching it. I'm like, it felt like every time I thought like something was good, I had to think, yeah, but about some other aspect of the movie. And after a while, it's just like, okay, yeah, there's too many, yeah, but about it. So I just like, it's just not working for me. Eyes Wide Shut, damn, I enjoyed better this time than I did last time. Like, I think Sidney Pollack is great in this movie. Like, he knows, you know, kids today would say, like, he understood the assignment. Sidney Pollack understood.
No issue with that, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, very, very atmospheric, and I think it wasn't until like really very, very recently that I realized that the guy playing Nick, the keyboard player, was the guy who directed Tar. Yeah. Did not make that connection. So after having gone back and watching 2001, I was like, well, you know, I should give Kubrick another shot. You know, that big ass Criterion thing is coming out soon.
And you're gonna buy it?
No. I want, like I told you guys, like, I would love to have 2001 on its own. Spartacus.
They're all there, Kevin. You can have that.
I don't.
You just have to buy the collection.
I don't want Lolita. And I don't want Barry Lyndon.
You'll have to have Full Metal Jacket also.
You just, like, you don't. And I don't want. You don't feel comfortable owning Lolita. Like, that can't be on your shelf.
That's not it. I've said before, like, this is my biggest problem with Kubrick is Kubrick fans. Like, people, these fans of Kubrick want to go on and on and on, you know, jacking off to the symmetry of Arlie Ermey walking up and down the barracks. But, like, nobody talks about the fucking Three Stooges level slapstick that's in Lolita. And, you know, just, oh yeah, like,
are you
saw
saying
Peter
that the Three
Sellers
Stooges are not good at slapstick?
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying it's real fucking weird to have it in a movie about this subject matter. And not to mention, like, it's obvious that, like, Kubrick, like, oh yeah, I really like Peter Sellers, like, these certain Peter Sellers bits, so I'm just going to have him, I'm just going to shoehorn these into this movie. So, yeah. And, like, I like The Killing. The Killing is really good.
But when every 5 seconds you have to have this same narration, 4:26 p.m.,
like, you are killing me with this. Yeah.
That's terrible.
I want people to at least acknowledge that Kubrick is not the perfect auteur, but they won't. They seem not to.
Yeah, but you just got to get back into Fear and Desire, man. Those slow motion shots with the smoke and the fog. Fuck.
Kubrick is.
I actually enjoyed Fear and Desire better last time I watched it. I mean, it wasn't awesome. A five like it was for you. But
it is.
Yeah. I don't know. Have you seen Killer's Kiss?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't remember anything.
I remember
about
very
it,
little
except
about
for
it.
That, I think there's that last shot where it's like circling the guy at the subway, or it might be based on the first shot actually. It's either the first or the last shot. And it's like circling the guy on the subway platform, the camera. I remember thinking that was cool, but I haven't seen that movie since I was like 17.
You know what?
So
you should do. Yeah. You should get the box and then rewatch Killer's Kiss. Let us know.
I will never buy that box.
Yeah.
I actually saw, I will say this. I'm not. Okay, I own almost no physical media at this point. I sold all my records. I sold almost every Blu-ray and DVD I own. I think I have like 3 or 4 things somewhere. Not even sure where they are. But I'll tell you, I was at Barnes & Noble right before we left, and the Arrow edition of Excalibur is there, and it is something to look at. I mean, it's like, I think it's like 5 discs, and it's just massive, and I was like, I might have to buy it. it's so good looking, and that's a movie. That's in my top 10. Like, that's a huge film for me. I would have to.
It's okay to own such a movie. That.
Yeah,
I know. I was like, what am I going to do? Own one movie? You know.
Yeah, I mean, I figured you'd have like some ultra super special edition of Apocalypse Now, and like maybe that's.
No,
that's
I
it,
sold but... everything. I sold that too. I was like, wow. I mean, and honestly, that doesn't even feel like something I'd want to own. I don't know why. I just don't even care. Like, yeah, I don't. I mean,
is it not your number one anymore?
It is, but I don't. I don't know. It's not the same. Maybe it's because I've seen it more or something. I don't. I owned multiple editions of it. Mm. It's also not a movie like I could rewatch Excalibur right now. Apocalypse Now is a bit of a heavier, you know, more difficult to. You gotta be in a mood to watch it, Apocalypse Now. But anyway, neither here nor there. I was just saying, I might pop on the Excalibur 4K at some point. It looks, it's too good. But and those those fucking A24 releases are insane. I want to pick up a couple of those. Zone of Interest and Warfare maybe. But anyway, okay. So moving on. I'm just going in order here. No, I'm not going to go in order. Fuck that. I watched The Duelists, which was a Ridley Scott film, his first film, 1977, which I had been meaning to watch for, you know, like 25, 30 years. And finally got around to it because I watched Spielberg's Duel, and I was like, I should watch Duelists. And it was really good. I really, really enjoyed this. I loved the performances, especially Keitel. He's such a piece of shit. He's like an asshole in this. And I love his hair. I love like the weird braids that they do in their hair. And I like how their hair changes over the course of the film.
Mm.
Because like the style is changing because it's like a 20-year span in the early 1800s. All the dueling scenes are really incredible. I love the final duel with the pistols. It's just such a weird, like, every time you think of a pistol duel, you think of like standing back to back and then 10 paces and they turn around. But this one's like, nah, he's just going to go into the woods and he's got two pistols and then you're going to chase them and try to see if you can catch him and shoot him. It's just such a weird, like, how is that a duel? It's so bizarre, but it's like, this is the world that The Duelist exists in. So yeah, I really, really, really enjoyed it. And I feel like it has nowhere to go but up on rewatch. I'm just going to power through a couple of these. Okay, real quick. Mm-hmm. I also watched Obsession, the big horror hit from the summer, directed by Curry Baker, which was good, very good. I understand the hype. Watching it, really great performances, really well-constructed narrative. If not, you know, pretty derivative of, like, really basic Twilight Zone-esque. The Monkey's Paw, obviously, is, like, a big thing here. It's, you know, it's just a lift of that story, essentially. But it's very well done, and it is effectively creepy, and there are moments where it was verging on Hereditary levels of creepy, which is pretty hard to do, I feel like. I really enjoyed it. And then I watched, right after that, went and saw The Death of Robin Hood, the Michael Sarnowski movie starring Hugh Jackman that I don't think anybody else in the world saw. With good reason, because this is not a good movie. Stars also Jodie Comer and Bill Skarsgård. Although I would defy you, if you didn't know Bill Skarsgård was in this, I don't think you'd like know that he was in it if you watched this movie, because I didn't know until the end. But this movie starts off the way like the way you would imagine this movie is, like you would think it's like, oh, this is like John Wick, you know, John Wick Robin Hood, right? And he's just killing guys, and he's the badass, you know, but he's older, so it's like the grizzled badass, you know. And it's essentially like it starts off and he's Robin Hood, but he has to live this like life of solitude because of all the crimes he's committed as an outlaw throughout his life. People are coming to try to kill him for revenge constantly. And the opening scene, he has to kill a woman who comes to try to kill him. The film is like a really, it's an interesting idea. It's trying to do this thing where it is examining his guilt about having done these things and his desire to like pay a penance, to be dead, to get killed for these things, but he can't make it happen. But unfortunately, it's just so goddamn boring for like the second two-thirds of the film. The first third is like it's 100% front-loaded with action. There's no action after like the 30-minute mark. But there's like a lot of really brutal, intense, bloody action in the first half hour or 20 minutes. And after that, it's about him recovering at this nunnery on an island and sort of coming to grips with who he is as a person and having to reveal things about his past and, you know, things like this. And it's an interesting idea. It's just not very well executed. I don't think Jackman's doing a great job here. Jodie Comer is the worst. I'm selling on her. She is awful. But yeah, other than that, it looks really nice. It's shot, you know, I think in on location somewhere in the British Isles. Looks wonderful, but it's a piece of shit. I would say avoid it at all costs.
Damn. You think they were going for a Avalon thing with Robin Hood on there?
I'm not sure what that means, Kevin. What is Avalon?
So Avalon is the island where ostensibly Arthur is like mortally wounded and then gets carted off and like spirited away to this Isle Avalon, and like the there's an idea that like Arthur was gonna come back. It's a lot of it is explored in The Bright Sword, and there's like that book in the miniseries Mists of Avalon. We were talking about Excalibur, so
sure. I mean, I don't that would have been an interesting connection to make. And truth be told, I saw this movie, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks ago now. There was some fleeting reference to Avalon or to Arthur in it. I don't recall. I just remember being like bored to tears throughout most of it, and like at the halfway mark I was like we gotta wrap this thing up, like let's
ouch.
I was expecting the sort of Hollywood direction of this film. You would assume that he gets to this island and he's going to have to, you know, he makes these new friends and Jodie Comer is so nice and beautiful and sweet and she's taking care of him that he has to protect her nunnery against vandals who come for him, you know, and there'll be like a sort of man with no name, you know, shootout at the end or killing spree at the end. But I mean, that doesn't have to end that way. Obviously, it's not a bad thing that it doesn't end that way, but it feels like it sets up for that and then nothing happens, like sort of nothing happens, you know? So it just wasn't for me. I don't know. It didn't work. I've seen some reviews that sort of made me like, I was like, maybe I should give it another shot at some point, but maybe like 10 years down the road, I don't see you rewatching anytime soon. JR?
I hate hearing this, but yeah. Okay. My guy, Sarnowski.
Your guy. He did one movie you like. Oh my god.
I picked up the checked out the new Blu-ray for Tobe Hooper's The Funhouse. 1981 horror film that he did. Why? That I'd never seen. Why?
Yeah.
I don't know. I often just kind of browse like what they have on order.
Okay.
When my library has an order, I'm just like, that sounds cool. And I recently rewatched Audition because they were getting the new Arrow Blu-ray, and I was like, cool. Sounds like a great reason to rewatch Audition. It's like this kind of thing where if I knew about The Funhouse and you were like, this is on Hulu, I'd be like, cool, I'm gonna put that on a watch list and I will never watch it. Even though like it sounds interesting to me, but if I check it out from the library, I will watch it. Yeah. So I make sure to check out things from the library. You know, support your local library, children. It's fun. Anyway, The Funhouse is like it's technically a slasher movie. It's set at a carnival. We have, a gang of carnies that end up kind of being our killers here. And there's a group of teens that lock themselves or hide and get stuck in this titular funhouse at the carnival for fun. That we want to spend the night. And I think it is a really interesting movie because it's a movie where it tries to just be like this weird vibes movie where we are just like hanging out at the carnival for 45 minutes. You know, like people are not getting killed. This is not really a horror film. It's a weird film. The most liked review on Letterboxd it's basically just a scene that I loved. The best part for me was a random old man points a shotgun at a boy he sees walking along the side of the road for no reason other than laughs. Like, that is a scene in this movie. It is a really weird scene, and there are several weird scenes that just are setting up that we are somewhere that is just kind of like weird and fucked up. It was great. And then the killings are happening, and it's just like a fun slasher movie. I was there for it. I liked it. Creative.
Cool. Kevin?
Nice. Okay. So continuing with the horror theme, I finally got around to watching Kiyoshi Kurosawa's Cure, which, you know, seen it on a bunch of lists, heard, yeah, you know, nothing but great things about it.
Is he about to say he hated it? I'm just kidding.
No, I gave it a four, man.
Okay.
No.
This guy loves Asian cinema.
Most of it, yeah.
Yeah, if it's Asian or British, he's in.
Shoot, what was that? Billy Liar? Was that the...
Yeah, you hated Billy Liar, I forgot.
Yeah, and you loved it.
Fucking awesome. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. Anyway, so, So Cure takes this idea that this guy is, like, making these suggestions to these people, and next thing they know, you know, they just have this very rational decision that the person that is nearest to them needs to be murdered. And it just kind of like keeps going, and eventually like this the cops like figure it out. Namely the guy from Perfect Days.
I don't remember his name.
Koji Yakusho. Janitor.
Oh.
Yeah. As a Detective Takabe.
It's like a cleaning attendant, all right?
Yeah. Custodial worker.
Yeah. I really, well, you know, enjoyed is an odd way to say it, but I really enjoyed this movie. It was intriguing. It was very, like, you know, you can sort of see like some influence from Seven in this movie, but also like you can see like JR, you know, mentioned Audition a minute ago, and like, yeah, like this is not nearly as visceral as Audition, but like the vibe, you know, set the tone for so much that came after it. So yeah, Cure is really good. Very worth your time. And I will be watching more Kurosawa in the future.
It's a wild ride.
Yes.
Some of the sections of the ride aren't very good.
Yeah.
It's okay.
I might check this one out. I'm sort of only seen two of this guy's films, and I didn't love either of them. But anyway, let's move on to what I watched. Just kidding. So I watched Shadowhunter from 1993, and I've been meaning to watch this for a while, and it just became available to me. This is from the director of the guy who did Forsaken, which was like that vampire movie from the early 2000s that I talked about a few years ago. I'm sure you guys don't remember. But had Jonathan Skaich in it. Anyway, Shadowhunter is starring Scott Glenn and Benjamin Bratt, but it's a movie about this LAPD detective who is tasked with bringing a serial killing Native American criminal guy to, like, he's been arrested and his job is like bring him to LA to have him, I guess, like, you know, tried for his crimes or whatever. Or maybe he's bringing him to a jail. I don't really remember. But anyway, the point is that the guy is like, he's like a shamanistic, you know, he's like, it's inferred that he has like powers, you know, like Native American magic powers, like from his whatever, shamanism. And, he ends up escaping. And then Scott Glenn has to team up with the local police people from the reservation, and they go like chasing him through the wilderness. And it's like, if it had somebody in it besides Scott Glenn, like a stronger performer in the center of it, I feel like it would have been like a big hit, honestly, because it's a really fun movie. It's like a lot of, it's just a good, like thriller, you know, like almost like a survival thriller, because they're like in the woods most of the time, like trying to capture him. And he's like in his dream, like the guy's like in his dreams, like freaking him out and shit. And, you know, it's all sorts of like weird mysticism going on. But then like Scott Glenn is just so, I mean, I kind of like Scott Glenn, but he's so fucking wooden. And he's just got no delivery. Like, it's just, hey, how you doing? We gotta go find this guy. It's just like, there's no, it's just, he's so fucking monotonous. But I still kind of like him. I don't know. It's weird to see this and then, like, think of him in, like, something like Training Day, you know, where he has, like, a big personality, his character does. But anyway, Shadowhunter, you know, if you can find this somewhere, good luck, but I think it's worth your time. It's fun, and it is on my potential deep dives list now, because I'll tell you what, the first like 10 minutes when he's in LA, the score is insane. Like, it is so saxophone heavy and like just like Lethal Weapon, the first Lethal Weapon times like 300. Like, wow. It's so fucking crazy. It's really, really great. And then the score becomes like a more synthy, you know, pan flute sort of thing whenever the Indians become involved, obviously.
Mm. Are you aware of
when did this come out, John?
1993.
Okay. Who do you think could have been
Harrison Ford or I think Harrison Ford would have been good, or even like a even that's weird though, because like the guy, there's like a weird like love story that happens in the middle of it too, where Scott Glenn's character manages to like like, it's sort of a thing, because like the woman who's the tracker that they hire to find Benjamin Bratt's character is just like impossibly good looking and young. And Scott Glenn's like 50, you know, but he somehow still seduces her and they sleep together. It's just like, I don't know. I'm not buying it. Well, maybe like a Bruce Willis even or something. I don't know. Some sort of like, you know, good looking movie star guy, more charisma.
Brandon Lee. But,
oh, hey, Brandon Lee would have been awesome.
Yeah.
If only. God, yeah, Brandon Lee. What could have been? I weep.
Yeah, for...
Do you know this guy, J.S. Cardone, directed 8mm too?
I did know that. I'm not terribly interested in J.S. Cardone except for Black Day, Blue Night. I do want to see that. I sort of want to see Outside Arizona, and I want to see The Slayer only because it's like his highest rated or highest popularity.
I feel like that would just get you to like the majority, like that you've seen half.
Not gonna watch,
and then just watch all the rest.
No, I'm not gonna watch 8mm 2. Sounds ridiculous. I don't know. Although it does have Jonathan Skaich. I fucking love Jonathan Skaich, dude. He's the star of it. Oh my god, I might have to pop. I might pop on this one. I don't know.
He's opening what? Plex as we speak.
Like, no, I don't have Plex anymore.
What? Is it the Doom generation that made you love him? What did, what makes you
no,
love him?
No, it was that thing you do, man. He's great in that thing you do. Come on.
Okay, all right.
He's when he sings his song and Tom
is
Hanks
he the is he the vocalist?
Yeah, and Tom Hanks says, "I want something poppy. I want something snappy." And he goes, "Okay." And he goes to the microphone and goes, "I quit. I quit." He's like sings, "I quit." It's so good, dude. It is. I quit, Mr. White. he has to put the button on it. I don't know. I dig him. And yeah, in the Doom generation, as ridiculous as that movie is, and his character is, and his performances, I still like. Yeah, I like him, and he's great in The Forsaken. Check out The Forsaken. And I remember liking him in the Houdini TV movie that he was in the early 2000s. But it's been a while. Who knows? Chair?
All right. Checked out Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die. You know, the latest Gore Verbinski. Decided, you know, sometimes his stuff is interesting. And Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die is interesting. Sort of. I don't know. It's like a time travel, like, fear of AI movie, which, you know, no problem with that concept. I think the mechanics of it feel really dumb in the moment. And then by the end, you're like, okay, I see what you did there. But that doesn't make it more enjoyable. It doesn't end in a way that makes me like feel like, oh man, that was like really smart and clever. It ends in a way that's like, this was still pretty dumb. And Sam Rockwell is having fun. Good for him. But this is it's a movie that's way too long and ultimately feels like a waste of time. And it was like it was a movie where like Zazie Beetz is in it. And I was like, man, it feels like she's too famous now to be in this incredibly small part. Cause she's like the lead of movies like They Will Kill You, which I also watched. And I recommend you not watch that. Not because...
Are you being serious when you say she's too famous for the movie?
She's too famous for the role she has in Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die, which is, like, just weirdly small.
Yeah. Just because you said that she's, like, she's too famous because now she's starring in her own movies. But I'm like, that nobody saw that movie that you're talking about that she starred in, right?
I know. I feel like people see movies that she's in. But, yeah, she's not... She's not, like, a movie star who commands money. She's not Zendaya. Zendaya.
Few are.
But, yeah, They Will Kill You is... I don't know. I think it wants to be like Old Boy and John Wick, and a comedy. And Zazie Beetz like infiltrates this hotel, condo complex as a cleaner, because people like employees seem to like disappear, and she knows that her long lost sister has started working for them. And it's a cult, and it's supernatural, like satanic or whatever. And right when it starts, I was like, oh, man, how are they going to, like, there's, like, something interesting here. How are they going to, like, kind of make this fit in 90 minutes? And it turns out they make it fit in 90 minutes by sort of revealing everything to you immediately and then just having it be, like, a mediocre action movie for 75 minutes. And I was like, that's okay. That's how I would have done it. So yeah, don't watch it.
I won't.
I knew you were going to, so don't do it.
Who directed it? Is it somebody of note or?
No, I mean, I don't recognize this person.
It's not like Kirill, one of the John Wick guys or something.
No, Kirill Sokolov, a Russian director who has not made anything I've heard of. All the Russians?
No, just kidding. I was just saying, like Timur Bekmambetov, that guy blows.
No, it does feel like, I mean, I'm sure he's not like in that school in the sense that there are peers. I mean, this guy is younger than I am, Sokolov, but like, it definitely, like, he's making, you know, action genre trash, according to his Letterboxd.
Now, look, Heather Graham, Patricia Arquette, and James Remar are in this motherfucker. Now, like,
it's really okay. Bizarre. James Remar is a voice. I wouldn't get too excited.
Well, that's a bummer.
Patricia Arquette has a pretty big role. I think she's great. Heather Graham doesn't. The deal here is that this is like a satanic cult where like they are granted immortality. So like Zizzy Beats like blows Heather Graham's head off very early.
Sweet.
Like she's alive, but her head is blown up in such a way that like her body does not fully come back together. She's like a walking head and like her eye is like traveling through vents. So like, I don't think Heather Graham filmed a ton on this movie. whereas like Tom Felton from Harry Potter, he keeps getting killed, but he keeps coming back to life, you know, fully formed.
He's pretty bad. I'm not excited about him.
He's not good in the movie. Yeah.
All right, Kevin.
Just to be clear, I would say spoiler, but again, that is all revealed in the first 10 minutes.
Right.
Oh, wow.
Very few reveals after the first 15. You know.
Well, JR, you want to talk In the Hand of Dante?
Okay. I forgot to be prepared for this.
Well, I mean, I told you guys, I think that the 5 minutes of Gerard Butler as the Pope is probably the best he's ever done. And like I also said, like if it was more than 5 minutes, it probably wouldn't be. But because it was so short and he's just has to stand there and be menacing, then yeah.
Well, what about Gerard Butler as Louis?
I don't know if Julian Schnabel knows anything about gangsters outside of what he's seen in gangster movies. And Louis is an amalgam of all of like the worst aspects of mafia hitmen in movies, in my opinion. And like, I don't know, he is entertaining in some ways, and the fact that he just, you know, gets killed off like fairly soon, you know, he's not there for a long, long time is, you know, probably for the best.
I appreciated the surprise of the movie, the scene in which he dies and a few other people die. The scene where he is introduced, where he has to go to that bar.
Yeah, that is like...
That scene made me quite angry.
Yeah, that's like...
It's like... The movie's long. I feel like what Butler is tasked with doing is like very familiar. We understand who this gangster is. And also we get to see him be that gangster plenty. In fact, like, you know, they could have been dropped off at that mansion and taken the stuff. And then he like shoots a dog and I would like, oh, I get it. Like I get it really quick. The scene in the bar was just like, why did you make me do this for 10 minutes? Why? I don't think it does anyone any favors. And like, you know, complaining about one scene like that that we might not need, like, whatever, I get it. But just like, the movie is long and it is meandering in ways that do not really work for me. And so I felt like in this sort of, in that present day story, I know it's not present day, it is more present than, you know, in Italy with Dante. I was like, man, just cut it out.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. Like, that scene, if not cutting it all the way out, then, like, it could have been so much shorter and still gotten the point across that this guy is, you know, really awful. He's a mafia hitman, and yeah.
But, I wish that I could get on this movie's, like, let's call it, like, wavelength. Neither section ever totally worked for me. Like, the first time we actually get to see Oscar Isaac as Dante, and we get to see Gal Gadot, and, like, that, like, wasn't working for me. But then, like, we get the Martin Scorsese stuff, and that actually, like, did work for me. And Butler worked for me. Pope Butler. Which is a good name for a pope, right? We should have a Pope Butler. That worked for me. But then, again, like, we would get a scene or two of Nick that I thought was interesting. And like, I just, but then, like, you know, we kill off our initial opponents, and then Jason Momoa, for some reason, is in this movie doing his thing. It could not all come together at any point for me. Ugh. I found it to be quite frustrating.
I do want to say, Al Pacino, also, you know, 5 minutes, but he was fucking great.
Yeah, but then our fucking friend John went and ruined that scene, telling me about all this, like, stupid, like, visible blood squib shit.
Well, you know.
I'm kidding. This scene wasn't ruined. I legitimately could barely tell what John was showing us.
Well,
I don't know. I noticed.
That's not a criticism of you, John. I just.
I know.
Yeah.
I was gonna say I'm sorry you guys didn't get it. You know.
Too highbrow
for you. Sure. That's okay. You
know. I mean, I like the idea that you know what. 800 years later, they're, you know, making an attempt for Dante to make good with his actual wife, you know,
like he never wrote about or whatever.
Yeah, like that's a nice romantic idea. It's just gets so convoluted with the crime aspects and. And it's like,
but that's that's another problem with this.
2 hours, like, and 45 minutes.
I feel like we're done. Like, the Gal Gadot experiment is over. Like, it's not working. Right.
I mean, I wouldn't say that she's horrible, but, like, yeah, I mean, you could have found a better actress for that role.
Yeah. She's the worst. I agree. I mean, she's, yeah, she's the thing in the film that I cannot and would not defend.
Mm.
Along with Momoa being involved, I don't like him either. But
no,
yeah,
and this is a, like, we gotta stop hiring these Justice League members. Like, their time is done. Zack Snyder is done. Like, we gotta move on.
I'm also stop putting Jason Momoa
in every movie.
Right. I'm terrified of Momoa coming back in Dune 3. The trailer is not instilling any confidence in me. He looks terrible in it. I'm really worried.
I don't mind Momoa at all in Dune. But just knowing.
He has to do something different.
Refamiliarizing with my source material. Mm. Yeah. I mean, he is right. Different. He, like, the character's different. He should be different.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I'm saying,
character's way more important.
He needs to be different. He needs to be different, and he does not appear to be different. That's my point. Like, in the trailer, I mean, granted, we're seeing, you know, 0.5 seconds of what's going on in the film, but, like, in the trailer, he does not appear to be different, other than the fact that he speaks to Paul like he doesn't know who he is or whatever. But other than that,
it
doesn't seem like that different of a performance, you know?
I'm choosing optimism for Dune 3, and... I don't think that series has given us any reason to be pessimistic, no. But I think Jason Momoa's past 5 years have given us reason to be pessimistic. I just hate how he's like not saying no, but I also hate how producers are just like every sort of like genre property, we got to put him in. You know, like you're going to be Lobo and Supergirl, which I have not seen. I've heard nothing good. He's in the fucking, he's in the Street Fighter movie that's coming out later this year. Like, why are you saying yes to Street Fighter? What's going on here, man? This is Eric intervention is required.
You had to.
But I also get like why Jason Momoa would want to say yes to this. I'm working with a guy who has, you know, made like Oscar nominees. I'm working with Oscar Isaac, who people consider good. We're dealing with classy source material, and my best friend Gal is already there, so I'll just shoot her.
Plus the sweet paycheck.
Yeah, for this movie.
Yeah, I mean, sure. You think this was a paycheck? I don't know. I mean, like, as in,
I'm sure
paychecks were very large.
I don't think it's large either, but I'm sure he made money.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
I'm sure he was paid for his time.
He's not like, you know, it's like he's doing Minecrafts, right? He's getting that Amazon paycheck with the Wrecking Crew. This guy.
I think that's
no shortage of the paychecks.
Sure, that's the answer to why he's in so much crap is because, like, why did he take Street Fighter? Because Street Fighter probably is paying him like $6 million to be in the movie, you know?
It probably is. I hated the trailer for Street Fighter.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
Hated it. And, yeah, like, something's going on here where, like, the whole cast is kind of like a joke.
Yeah.
You know, like,
they got like all right comedians in there, and
but Eric Andre and the Eric country Andre, singer Orville Peck is Vega, and Kyle Mooney's in this. Like, it's there must you can't be make something a, comedic going on, but like the trailer doesn't really have that.
No, it's like you can't because there's a formula now to.
Too late.
Revamping a property from the early 90s or from the 80s, and the only way to do it is through satirical comedy and like poking fun at it. You couldn't possibly make a Street Fighter film that was, you know, serious in any way, which is, and I'm not saying they should. I think they should not make a Street Fighter film is the answer, but you know, yeah. It's just like it just feels like it's very formulaic at this point. It's like Every one of these properties gets made. It's the exact same playbook,
but this sort just, of
you
like,
know, we have to make fun of it, or else it's not gonna, nobody will like it because see that we get like it. We're in on the joke. It's stupid. You know,
this post irony thing is dying. I feel like Street Fighter is showing up too late. I have suspicions that it will be awful.
I mean, I'm sure it'll be awful, but. Will other people think it's awful is the question, right? Now, speaking of awful, I watched Nemesis, which a great many people, this is from 1992, directed by Albert Pune, which a great many people seem to think is an awful movie, but they're wrong. It's great. This is a totally, I feel like, slept on just actioner from the early 90s with some of the most wonderful squib work I've seen in years, and not just blood squibs, mind you, but like hits on walls, at the beginning of this film, the main character blows open like a gate with a shotgun. It looks just incredible. I don't know. Some like truly inspired action sequences in a film that is, I'll grant you, poorly conceived, poorly acted, like embarrassingly bad performances. But I don't know. I'm so tired of like watching people bitch quality and moan about how bad performances are in something like this. Like this is the level that this movie deserves. You know what I mean? It deserves to have a Belgian kickboxer guy as the star who's never acted before. That's fine. Because he looks great. He looks, he looks like discount Jean-Claude Van Damme, and he's ripped, and he knows how to move, and he points the gun right, and it looks good. And he's just horrible at delivering lines, and that's okay. I don't understand why anybody cares about that. Like, why are we judging these movies like they should have, Oscar-level performing in them? They shouldn't. It should just be great, great squib work and great action set pieces, and which this film has in spades. And it's a cyberpunk sort of thing. That's how I came to it after having read Neuromancer and watching Johnny Mnemonic again. Somehow came across this. Oh, it was in my feed. It was in my TikTok feed. There was a scene from it. I was like, what the fuck is this? And there was a guy wielding like a 50 cal machine gun, like one of those things you'd see on top of like an M1 Abrams tank. And he was holding it like it was a rifle, you know? And just like hip firing it at this woman point blank and missing, right? But amazing, because like she was firing back, and it was just so chaotic, the amount of squibs in the walls and the ceiling. It was just it was absolutely astonishing. I loved it. So yeah, I would highly recommend Nemesis 1992, just the first one. Now I'm scared to watch the second one. Okay?
Don't do that. You can't say all this shit and then say you're not going to watch 2, 3, and 4.
Okay, look.
Also directed by Peter.
Yes, and I wasn't going to get into this, but I did try to watch Mean Guns, the Albert Pune film from 1997 starring Christopher Lambert and Ice-T, which is about 100 criminals who are brought to a prison, a newly opened prison. And they're given all the guns and baseball bats and knives, and they're the last one standing wins $10 million. And I tried to watch this movie because I said, you know what? That's a goofy concept. That's like the thing I would come up with when I was like 12. But maybe it's got some cool action because Nemesis rocked, you know? And you're watching this movie, and they're shooting each other, and they're beating each other to death, and there's literally not a drop of blood in this R-rated action crime thriller.
Wait, what the fuck is it called? I can't find it.
It's called Mean Guns, M-E-A-N Guns, and it's got no blood, no squibs, nothing, right? And the whole and you get to reading about it. I was reading like the trivia for it. I'm like, why? Like, why isn't there any blood? Why aren't there any squibs? It's because they actually filmed in a prison that was new, brand new, and they were terrified they were going to mess something up, and they didn't have the budget to fix anything. So they just did away. No squibs, no blood. We just shoot around everything. And it was such a bummer, because, like, what a lot of fun this could have been. And apparently they paid Christopher Lambert, like, $2 million for, like, 3 days of work, like, just to have him in the movie. It's so bad. But I don't know. I'm not sold on Pune. And again, I tried to watch Cyborg also.
I thought you were... Okay,
Yeah, I know. I was going to try to go down the rabbit hole. I think I'm going to stick with, like, lesser things. Like, I really want to see this Alien from L.A. movie that he did. And maybe, like, Omega Doom. You know, some of the lesser known things.
Not Captain America?
No, I wouldn't
watch that. Which must be like, what he's the most infamous for.
I think Cyborg is probably the thing that he's most known for. I mean, this is
really
top of the list on his
filmography. Well, just like Captain America is like an infamous sort of like, oh God, failure.
Yeah, it's bad.
That wasn't really the best.
That's true. But I don't know. I mean, I definitely, I'm not like, I will watch more Albert Pune films, but I'll tell you, Cyborg was difficult to get through the first like 10 or 15
minutes. Look, I'll go down this rabbit hole with you.
Is brutal.
I'm not going to go down the rabbit hole with you if you're going to be such a coward. Because right? I immediately want to see Knights.
I want to see Knights too. That's a big one. I want to see that. I would encourage you to watch Nemesis, and if you feel similar, if you have similar sentiment to me about Nemesis,
I'm gonna watch all four.
Okay, well that's insane. Just watch the first one.
Relax. Chet Stahelski plays Nebula in Nemesis 2. Nebula.
Yeah, I knew. Yeah, I saw that.
And Alex is recast, anyway. Reborn as a 80s bodybuilder, mm-hmm. Sue Price. I don't know who this person is.
Yeah, I guess they couldn't get Olivier Gruner back. Gruner, mm-hmm. I don't know. Anyway. but anyways, yeah, that's Nemesis. JR?
Okay. What else do I have to talk about? I watched Project Hail Mary. Just figure.
I should Kevin? Mention
it since it's a big deal. Okay.
Just kidding. All right. Just kidding. Okay. Just kidding. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, this is the like kind of hopecore bullshit I thought it would be. I do think like some of the things look cool, and you know, like I respect and appreciate that so much of this was done as practical effects and with puppetry, and all that shit is cool to know about. It's like, I, you know, you had talked about like people think this movie looks good while it doesn't, and I think you're right. I think like aspects of it are cool, and there are certain things that look cool, but like it does not look good as a movie. And you know, like Ryan Gosling seems to like he does well. I thought it was like pretty cool that they gave this part to Sandra Hüller. Like I think worse directors like would take notes from a studio like, this needs to be someone more famous and hotter. So I'm glad she had that role, because I like her in general. I'm glad Lionel Boyce from The Bear is getting more work. I have no clue why Lord and Miller were like, we need the AT&T girl for this specific role that hardly exists. Not that I dislike her. It's just strange. But yeah, like this is not like offensive. It's just sort of, it's like nothing. Again, I think this, the story itself, is a waste of time. And, you know, they didn't change anything in the adaptation that would change my mind.
This is my cousin Mike says this is the best film of the last 20 years. So,
and I'm so happy that a movie has been released that cousin Mike can feel strongly about. I do think it's cousin so true, Mike yeah, should watch more movies.
I agree, right? He probably has had like no feeling about a movie in so long that that's the knee jerk reaction, right?
But
it's just this is like, the best movie ever.
This, I mean, it's movie fine. It's has fine. Like elicits like really strong responses from people, and like who of typically course, yeah. like in my life who don't typically care about movies, and that is cool. And I'm not gonna go out there and be like, the movie's actually fucking dumb.
No, I agree.
Lego movie's better.
He insisted we watch it when I was staying with him before we found the apartment. And he insisted we watch this movie. And I was like, okay, you know, give it a shot. I was going to probably see this eventually. And then we watched it. And I was like, yeah, you know, in my mind, I'm like, this is like a 2.5. It's not, you know, it's not my thing. But I didn't say that to him. You know, I was like, oh, yes, I love the part where this happened. You know, I liked Ryan Gosling was a lot of fun in the movie, you know? Like, you know, I was very positive about it. I didn't want to, like, offend him or anything. Yeah. But, you know, yeah, it's pretty much trash, though. Kevin?
It's so funny because, like, I've heard a lot of, like, positive things about this movie. But just the other day, there was this grandma who was coming through the library. She was like, have y'all read or seen Project Hail Mary? Don't. It's trash.
Uh-oh.
So, yeah. Hey,
she didn't like it.
Fuck yeah, yeah, grandma.
Yeah.
Give me your Letterboxd account.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll rapid fire a couple and then I'll be done. So I watched the 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, which is a...
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was on the Roku channel. Yeah, really wacky live action movie from Dr. Seuss. It's directed by Roy Rowland, but like you look at this and you can tell it's Seuss's really interesting but a little overly long, so but still, like, I would definitely say it's worth checking out. Watched it because it's one of Soderbergh's top 10, so, and that was also why I watched Z by Costa Gavras. Interesting French political thriller, and it's interesting how, like, late 60s, the whole, like, you know, controlling the narrative, like, yeah, like, that's super relevant today. Like, you know, you guys have probably seen all the stuff about, is Mitch McConnell dead? Or is he not? We don't know.
Super dead.
Yeah, so, like, yeah. Yeah. So then also watched The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, Richard Burton in a John le Carré film. Interesting spy stuff. Like, I felt bad for this. Who's Oscar Werner, the guy who played Montag in Fahrenheit 451. Like, this guy is, like, given so bad. He's given the runaround so bad by Richard Burton and by his betters in the German word in is. They're commies. So, but yeah, he's, like, just losing his mind, and it's, like, the ending was a bummer, though. And I also watched a couple of kids' movies, so I decided I would watch the Transformers movie from the mid-80s. I was never really a big Transformers guy. But I was like, oh, you know, this is maybe something that I can watch with the boys.
Orson Welles.
Yeah. Like, the cast is stacked. You got Orson Welles. You got Eric Idle from Monty Python.
Meredith,
you got
Burgess, right?
Burgess
Meredith. Sorry, I said Meredith. Burgess Meredith. Isn't Burgess Meredith one of the actors? One of the voices?
I could be wrong. I'm not seeing him here, Lloyd.
I might be getting it confused with G.I. Joe, the movie.
Maybe. But yeah, like Leonard Nimoy, Scatman Crothers. Yeah, I when we finished it, I told the boys, like, you know, for a nonstop action movie, it was kind of boring.
Ouch.
Yeah. But I mean, at least the concept was interesting. The animation is really good. And yeah, like Orson Welles as this, like, planet eating thing, that was really interesting.
It is G.I. Joe, the movie that Burgess Meredith is in, by the way. Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. This came out, like, the same year.
Not surprised.
They're together in my mind forever.
Yeah. And yesterday, Sebastian and I watched The Brave Little Toaster. And, like, it was funny. I was going through Disney looking for something to watch, and I saw that, like, somebody had started watching it. I was like, you guys started watching this? Isn't it kind of scary? He goes, yeah, you know, there's some scary stuff. I was like, oh, well, do you want to watch it? I'll watch it with you. He's like, sure. And, yeah, like, I know I watched this a lot as a kid, but, like, watching it now is like, oh, no. No, that's fucked up. And you can
the
say that.
The toaster?
You
can say,
well, okay, so
I have no memory of the specifics of the toaster movie.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Brave Little Toaster, there's, like, so, like, you take the basic thing of, like, there's all these appliances who miss their owner, who they continually call the master. And, okay, like, this one little, like, electric blanket is so distraught over the fact that, like, they have probably been abandoned. And it's like, yeah, it's like opens up, like, really, like, man, this is, like, emotionally heavy. And then it only gets, like, crazier from there, because, like, Phil Hartman. So Phil Hartman plays two characters. One is an air conditioning unit where he's doing a blatant Jack Nicholson. And that one, like, they say something that upsets him, and he, like, freaks out, turns red, starts spitting sparks, and sounds like he's drowning to death. And then he pops, and, you know, he looks dead. Jeez. So yeah, we're starting. Okay. We're starting off the movie like this, and then, like, the toaster has this insane nightmare sequence. Like, starts off with, like, him and the kid, the master. Like, he's just, you know, making some toast. Next thing you know, there's smoke coming out of him. The smoke forms a hand and grabs the kid and yanks him out of the kitchen. Then you see this fucking satanic evil clown dressed as a firefighter, and then the toaster's, like, hanging on the curtain rod above a bathtub and falls to his death in this bathtub. And that's the end of the nightmare. But then when he wakes up, there's this storm, and the blanket gets blown away, and they think that he's gone forever. And then the lamp gets struck by lightning.
Yeah.
It's crazy, man.
Okay.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
All right. This is my last thing. I saw my first movie here yesterday, which was the Moana remake, which was fine, better than I expected it to be. And The Rock was a lot of fun in it. He was funny. I laughed. And then today I went to the theater I've been wanting to go. We saw that one in a mall, but, today I went to the theater I've been wanting to go to, which is called the Plaza Theater. And where they're currently showing The Odyssey on 70. And I saw a Colombian film called Barrio Triste, and which was executive produced by Harmony Korine, and it's directed by somebody named Stills, who I guess is like a music video type guy, maybe. And you know, this movie was my kind of thing, right up my alley. It's something that JR will hate when he eventually forces himself to watch it. But, but you know, the problem was that right before I saw this movie, I wasn't running late, but I was, like, on a tight schedule to get there. And I stopped at Burger King to eat a small meal, 4 chicken nuggets, a hamburger, and some fries. Like a regular, you know, little tiny hamburgers they have.
Sure.
And I ate that and I felt great. I was like, this is great. And I went and got a big Coke Zero, sat down in my seat, smallest theater I've ever been in. I mean, it was incredible. I love it. And surrounded by, you know, like-minded people who were very quiet during the screening. And we watched this movie, which is a really intense fever dream type stuff. A score by Arca, which was absolutely incredible. I mean, it might be one of the better scores of the last, you know, 100 years or so. Just an incredible film score. I really can't say enough good about the score. But unfortunately, the Burger King was not sitting right, and I was feeling so nauseous about midway through. And the film is 100% handheld, pretty much. It sort of has a found footage aspect to it in a way, and it was just making me very like I was like dying, and like about maybe half an hour left in the movie, I was just like, I don't know what I'm gonna do here. And I was having to like close my eyes for certain moments, you know, just like sort of like recalibrate. And I was like feeling super tired. So I didn't, unfortunately, I wasn't able to give this movie the attention that it deserved. But I, based on, you know, my I tried to separate my nausea from Burger King from the film itself, and I still think the movie was quite good and worked. It was very effective. And
why would I hate this? This was on my I was looking forward to this. Why will I hate it?
Just because it's like Harmony Korine's involvement, and Harmony it's very much like a, you can see why Harmony Korine was interested in this.
I did not know about the Korine involvement. I knew is this was like a music video director for Bad Bunny.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know anything about him, or like, I just saw this trailer and I was like, wow, this shit looks great. So, and I was like, and it's playing here. I was like, this is why I moved here, is because movies like this are going to play here. You know, I mean, this is perfect. So I was like, yeah, I'm going to fucking see this. I honestly, they played Do the Right Thing last weekend, and I really wanted to see that. I just didn't have time. But, yeah, so anyways, it's definitely, it's great. I mean, I'm not saying you're going to automatically hate it. You might enjoy it. I don't know. But I'd be curious about your thoughts for sure, because it is definitely strange in a great way. And again, that score is just wonderful. And the guy next to me, I walked past him on the way out, and he was like, they were talking about the movie. He was like, it's edgelord shit. And it's funny because Harmony Korine's production company is called Edgelord, you know, so it's like obviously it's Edgelord shit, bro. You gotta get it right. Anyway, it actually did have sort of similar vibes at moments to Baby Invasion, but only in the fact that it's like this sort of nonstop, you know, again, fever dream-esque. This movie's a little more languid than that, though, I guess. It's got this central performance in it by some kid, you know. He's never acted in anything. He plays Juan, and he's, like, crying and shit. It's really good. Like, he's really fucking good. It's crazy. I don't know if he's, like, if it's real, if it's, like, actually talking about his own life or something when he's having this moment, but it's crazy. Anyway. That's it for me. I'm out.
Look, I had written down one more film, but we don't need to talk about a Petty Clarkson movie if we don't have to. Because we all know.
Up to you, man.
Just kidding. High Art, Lisa Chulodenko, Patricia Clarkson as a German drug addict. Not great. Ali Sheedy, pretty good. That's it. Movie not good.
What's her face is in that from Rhoda Mitchell. Yeah,
she's also like not great, but
yeah, I don't like her.
Whatever.
I didn't like this movie either when I saw it. It's been a long time ago, but
yeah, it's too much.
What do you
foreshadow your tragedy a little bit harder? Anyway,
I don't remember anything about it. Okay, Kevin, you have anything else?
Nah, I'm out.
All right, so it's next time it's JR's pick. Now, JR, lay it on us. We all know it's coming.
So, I wanted to get us out to the theater. I want to go see a movie that none of us have been talking about, that no one in the world's really been talking about.
Yeah, it's a very obscure film.
I think we should
film.
Just try to go see, it's called The Odyssey. It's based on based on this play that some people have read. A poem. It's basically like, are we okay? You know, we don't usually go see movies in theaters. Are we okay kind of paying the literal like $17 to $25 to do that? Because I'm obviously not going to force you to do that if we don't want to do it.
I mean, I'm down.
Okay, listen. I'm down, and I probably will see this movie in the theater next weekend. I had a pseudo plan to, because my sister's going to be in town. She might watch my kid for me, and we're going to go. Me and Nicole might go see it. But I was also, prior to that plan, I was planning to watch, there's a like a Cam bootleg online. I was just going to watch the bootleg, honestly. I could give a fuck. I almost want to watch the Cam.
I mean, whatever.
Because I am so tired of the talk about the aspect ratio and about the 70 millimeter and the IMAX and how you can't even fucking see it and like the way it's intended, blah, blah. Who gives a fuck? Like, I'm so sick of, like, when you think people have gotten over their Nolan worship, man, I don't understand, like, what it is about this guy. And, I mean, the trailers don't even look good. I don't know. I'm so lukewarm on this fucking movie. But I have not seen it.
I'm lukewarm on Nolan, right? Like,
sure.
Just in general. Yeah, lukewarm on Nolan. I'm not cold, actually, but
room temp.
No, I mean, you liked Oppenheimer. Come on.
I liked Oppenheimer. I liked Dunkirk. That's it. It's over. It's two films out of a 10-film filmography.
We are not, as a group, as a unit, we're not really Nolan people, I don't think. I think we all like certain Nolan projects and all have serious misgivings about movies that many people on the internet seem to think are perfect.
Yes.
But, you know, like, looking at you, Interstellar, like,
yeah.
What the fuck's going on with the public in Interstellar? Because that movie's freaking idiotic.
It makes dumb people feel smart. You know,
kind of movie it's so odd. Embarrassing that people that movie's smart. It's like Denver now has a 70 millimeter IMAX screen, but for the next 2 weeks, I'd have to be sitting, like, no screenings are sold out, but I would have to be in like the first two rows. I'm not doing that. So like, I'm not worried about, you know, ratio. I'm just going to go see what's most convenient in terms of location and time, you know, for my convenience.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah,
I'll go see the 70 because it's playing at the Plaza. And I didn't talk about how great the Plaza is. It's an amazing theater, very old school. Feels a lot like the Broad Theater in New Orleans or Segan in its heyday. Very, you know, just small cinemas, great. But I just want to go back there for like every movie that I ever see. So they're playing it in 70 there, so I'll probably watch it in 70 there. But
70 or 70?
They're also just 70. They're playing the 70 IMAX in I think at that mall that I was at yesterday, because they had a big, huge sign about it, which is pretty crazy. Although I'm not sure it was 70, it might have been like 70 digital IMAX or something, because I know they were talking about how the 70 millimeter IMAX projectors like haven't been made in like 25 years, and they're having to like source parts from broken down ones to make sure that some of them can run. It's only like 26 places in the entire fucking country where you can actually see the thing, 70 IMAX. But I don't give a fuck about any of that. I don't even care if it's in 70. I'll watch the 35. I'll watch it on my phone. I don't care. It's not that important to me, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, you're forcing us to watch it for the episode. I'll watch it. That's fine, you know.
I'm not forcing you. I asked a question.
No, it's the pick. I'll watch it. That's good. I'm not Jordan. I will watch anything you say. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just gonna see whatever, you know, is cheapest at Perkins Row. Not this.
There you go.
Not this coming Friday, but the next, because I'm off. I make a point to only see movies in the morning on, you know, a weekday where, like, it's a pretty good chance no one's going to be there, or, like, there's going to be five people there. Like, that's a great way to do it.
I agree. Yeah. 100%. I mean, we saw Moana and there was 1,000 people there, and there was some fucking asshole in his family, and he had a 6-month-old who was screaming for like 30% of the movie, and they finally left, and it's like, thank God, like, what are you doing? Like, go home. Why are you here? You know?
Yeah, I mean, like,
yeah, that's stupid.
It's insane.
Yeah.
That's like,
she clearly wasn't interested.
Yeah.
6-month-old in a theater is tough. That's not like a place where like you have to be with a kid.
No.
Which I mean, I also like, I understand it's harder to see movies when you have small kids, but
well, just don't go see movies then. That's all. You know, I didn't take Amelia to go see anything when she was one. You know, what's the point of that? Like, sorry, you know, I just stay home. That's okay. Not a big deal. Anyway. Fuck it. John, Ryan, your movie is to watch. Homework. Wise. Letterboxd. Your movie is Night and Day from 2010, directed by James Mangold, starring Tommy Cruise and Cam Diaz.
Fuck, you're welcome, man. What the shit?
You haven't seen it. I think it's a great choice.
I know I haven't seen it. That's on like a I'm never gonna watch this list.
Not anymore, bud.
Oh, man.
Not anymore. If it helps, it has Viola Davis, Paul Dano, and Peter Sarsgaard in it as well.
It doesn't help. That doesn't help.
And Gal Gadot. Like, hey, Gal Gadot.
I'm pretty sure Mangold's bad. I don't know, man.
He did Copland. That was okay.
I understand that you like Copland.
It was okay. It's not.
No, I haven't seen it.
Oh, well.
All right. Well, that's it.
You love Ford versus Ferrari.
Yeah.
And probably Identity.
Yeah. I watched something recently that reminded me of Identity. Oh. Yeah. Good luck. Have fun. Don't die. Reminded me of Identity.
Which oh, really?
Is probably not a good thing for that movie. There are just like elements of the setup that that felt familiar. That was like a on repeat for months when I was in middle school movie.
Hey, I watched it a ton when it came out. I saw it in theater with my dad, and then we owned the DVD and we fucking ran it into the ground, man. I watched it all the fucking time. John's. I was in a big John C. McGinley phase, which is, I know, weird sounding, but like,
it is.
I thought John C. He was like one of my favorite actors of the time. It was like him. It was all these character actors. It was like him and Tom Sizemore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like just like these weird sort of like, you know, these actors who never starred in anything but were like really big presences on like the, you know, periphery of the cast. Anyway,
and I saw Identity like way before I watched any like Scrubs, where obviously John C. McGinley was a huge
deal. See, I never watched Scrubs. Yeah, I didn't give a fuck about that.
I never watched Scrubs. I did see I already brought this up once because of Mayor Winningham, but that movie Shy People has an early Pruitt Taylor Vince performance.
That guy.
The youngest son of this really fucked up Bayou Louisiana family. Shy People is not a good movie, but
he's from really Louisiana, I think.
He is, yeah.
Yeah. Nicole met him once. Anyway.
Yeah, he's Superman's dad.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see how long that lasts. DC's going in the tubes. Anyways, that's our show. Thanks for listening. Write to us, filmyakpodcast@gmail.com. Visit our website, filmyakpodcast.com. And we'll be back with episode 195 and The Odyssey. Ooh, The Odyssey. Only about a month late on that, you know, whenever we get back with that episode. But you know
which
what?
I think is appropriate for us.
Yeah.
That's very us.
We'll catch it after everybody, after all the hype has died down and nobody wants to hear any more about The Odyssey. That's when we'll release our review.
We're going to have brand new takes about
yeah.
Homer's epic poem that no one's ever heard before, right?
Totally. That's what we're known for. All right, well, that's it. So thanks for listening. Bye-bye.